The following short story is from the book Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. The short story is told by the teacher for whom the book is titled Ishmael. This is the story that Ishmael tells. The story that I am telling takes place a half a billion years ago, an inconceivably long time ago, when this planet would be all but unrecognizable to you. Nothing at all stirred on the land except the wind and the dust. Not a single blade of grass waved in the wind. Not a single cricket chirped. Not a single bird soared in the sky. All of these things were tens of millions of years in the future. Even the seas were eerily still and silent, for the vertebrates, too, were tens of millions of years away in the future. But of course, there was an anthropologist on hand. What sort of world would it be without an anthropologist? He was, however, a very depressed and disillusioned anthropologist, for he had been everywhere on the planet looking for someone to interview, and every tape in his knapsack was still as blank as the sky. But one day, as he was moping along beside the ocean, he saw what seemed to be a living creature in the shallows offshore. It was nothing to brag about, just a sort of squishy blob, but it was the only prospect he'd seen in all his journeys, so he waded out to where it was bobbing in the waves. He greeted the creature politely and was greeted in kind, and soon the two of them were great friends. The anthropologist explained as well as he could that he was a student of lifestyles and customs and begged his new friend for information of this sort, which was readily forthcoming. "And now," he said at last, "I'd like to get on tape, in your own words, some of the stories you tell among yourselves." "Stories?" the other asked. "You know, your creation myth, if you have one." "What is a creation myth?" the creature asked. "Oh, you know," the anthropologist replied, "the fanciful tale you tell your children about the origins of the world." Well, at this, the creature drew up indignantly, at least as well as a squishy blob can do, and replied that his people had no such fanciful tale. "You have no account of creation, then?" "Well, certainly we have an account of creation," the other snapped, "but it is definitely not a myth." "Oh, certainly not," the anthropologist said, remembering his training at last. "I'd be terribly grateful if you would share it with me." "Very well," the creature said. "But I want you to understand that, like you, we are a strictly rational people who accept nothing that is not based on observation, logic, and the scientific method." Of course," the anthropologist agreed. So at last the creature began its story. "The universe," it said, "was born a long, long time ago, perhaps 10 to 15 billion years ago. Our own solar system, this star, the planet, and all of the others seem to have come into being some 2 to 3 billion years ago. For a long time, nothing whatever lived there. But then, after a billion years or so, life appeared." "Excuse me," the anthropologist said. "You say that life appeared. Where did that happen, according to your myth? According to your scientific account." The creature seemed baffled by the question and turned a pale lavender. "Do you mean in what precise spot?" "No, I mean, did it happen on the land or in the sea?" "Land?" the other asked. "What is land?" "Oh, you know," he said, waving toward the shore, "the expanse of dirt and rock that begins over there." The creature turned a deeper shade of lavender and said, I can't imagine what you're gibbering about. The dirt and rocks over there are simply the lip of the bowl, the vast bowl that holds the sea." "Oh, yes," the anthropologist said. I see what you mean. Quite. Go on." "Very well," the other said. "For many millions of centuries, the life of the world was merely microorganisms floating helplessly in a chemical broth. But little by little, more complex forms appeared, single-celled creatures, slimes, algae, polyps, and so on. But finally, the creature said, turning quite pink with pride as he came to the climax of his story. But finally, jellyfish appeared. In the story that I just read from the book Ishmael, author Daniel Quinn presents an intriguing account of an extended dialogue between a teacher and his student. Now, this is not the story I just read between the anthropologist and the jellyfish. That's a story within the story. The larger context, the larger story, explores our understanding and attitudes about how and why humanity came into existence, our relationship with the world we inhabit, and the pervasive role that culture plays determining our beliefs and actions. The book begins with the book's unnamed narrator, a disillusioned throwback from the 1960s and 70s, reacting angrily to an item he read in the personal section of the newspaper. The notice read, "Teacher seeks pupil. Must have an earnest desire to save the world. Apply in person." Knowing that this is a certain scam, yet another charlatan soliciting unsuspecting novitiates, as our narrator once was, he marches down to personally witness the charade. He enters a rather plain building and an even more drab, sparsely furnished office. Along one wall, there's a large plate glass window looking into an otherwise windowless second room. Certain that behind the plate glass there will be some article of worship, some object of idolatry, he peers through the glass only to be startled by a large pair of eyes staring back at him. The eyes belong to a full-grown gorilla, Ishmael. Startled by his discovery, our disillusioned storyteller begins to silently question what he has found. Imagine his surprise when his own silent thoughts and speculations are responded to telepathically, and that these responses have come from Ishmael. In the solitude of this bleak space, and certainly questioning his own sanity, our narrator finds himself in silent conversation with this enormous gorilla. At one point, he wonders to himself, "And you are?" And Ishmael responds silently, "I am the teacher." Without a word spoken, Ishmael begins to teach his new pupil the lesson that humanity desperately needs to hear. Ishmael begins with some preliminary observations. The most significant of these is that humanity is living in the midst of a great story. The story is all around us. We live and we breathe the story. It is, in fact, so ingrained in our being that we no longer recognize it as a story. Our thoughts and actions are completely determined by the assumed truthfulness of this story. And yet we have no idea, no recognition that it could be otherwise. Mother culture is the term that Ishmael uses to describe the purveyor of this collective cultural teaching. Mother culture teaches us that this story is just as it should be. To step out of the story is to fall off the edge of the world. The story that we are living out is what Ishmael calls our creation myth. It explains how things have come to be as they are. We know about the Big Bang, the origin of the universe, the galaxies in our solar system. We know about the origin of life, evolution, and about hunter-gatherer cultures. We know about the beginning of civilization, industrialization. And if the book Ishmael had been written 15 years later, I'm sure it would say that we know about the World Wide Web. More importantly, from our story, from our creation myth, we believe, we know, and we act exactly as if this world in which we live was created for us, for humans. Everything in the world is here for our enjoyment, for our use. But our creation myth continues. Like the jellyfish in the earlier reading, we are certain that humanity has been the aspiration of creation. Not only was the world created for us, but as the apex of creation, it is in fact our destiny to rule, to control, and to dominate the earth. This is humanity's creation myth. This is mother culture. This is the story that each of us grows up with, and this describes perfectly how we act. We know no other way to be. As Unitarian Universalists, most of us in this room would be quick to claim that we do not believe in such a myth, that we have moved beyond this irrational anthropocentric mythology. As Unitarian Universalists, we would be quick to point to our seventh principle, our affirmation that we have the greatest respect for the interconnected web of all existence of which we are a part. I can see Ishmael lowering his head to his hands, shaking his head from side to side, knowing full well that we too live within the myth. I can hear Ishmael in his Socratic style of teaching asking us questions about our practices, our habits, the ways we use the earth. Perhaps Ishmael would guide us to discover the inconsistencies between our affirmations and our actions. We too are subjected to the story of mother culture that mother culture teaches, and we too act out of that story, even with our claim that we know and act differently. It is ingrained in our very beings. Ishmael would ask us about our use of the earth and its resources to help us discover what may be hidden from our eyes. Ishmael claims that it has not always been this way. In his telling of history, and I don't have time to relate the way he uses the Genesis story, from which I promise you will never read the book of Genesis the same way. In Ishmael's telling of history, he divides the world into leavers and takers. Leavers, or leaver culture, began when humans first appeared on the earth. Leavers were fair participants in the natural world as they competed for food, created dwellings, and coexisted with the rest of creation. In contrast to leaver culture, Ishmael describes taker culture, which he claims began 10 to 12,000 years ago with the development of agriculture. After this juncture in history, we, takers, no longer saw the earth as a source of nourishment. Rather, we saw the earth as something to be conquered, to be mastered, to be controlled. And we saw ourselves as earth's master. We saw the earth only as a resource for our use. The notion of mastering the earth did not occur all at once or even in one locale. It was not a grand scheme or plot. But as we gained the ability to put more and more land under cultivation, we began what can be seen as nothing less than a feeding frenzy, and it continues to this day. Ishmael guided his student into discovering what is done in taker culture that is never done in the natural world. In other words, Ishmael reveals the natural law that takers consistently violate. In leaver culture, leavers compete for food, but like other competitors, they hunt only for what they need to eat. On occasion, they kill to protect their food, but they do not actively seek to destroy their competitors. Takers, on the other hand, act as if we are exempt from the laws of competition. In an unscrupulous way, takers actively work to exterminate their competitors. We do more than simply compete for food. We wage war on our competitors. Now, I'm not an expert in antitrust law, but I believe there are strong parallels. In the business world, there is a distinction between competing for market share and actively working to destroy one's rivals. As takers, our greed is catastrophic. We systematically destroy the food supply of our competitors if it serves our purposes. And we claim all available land, water, and air to satisfy our needs. We do not hesitate, excuse me, we do not do this because of our need for food. We take other lands and resources for business and industry to satisfy our material wants. Wants. I want to explore one idea a little differently than did Ishmael. In Lever culture and the cultures that existed before the arrival of human beings, I believe that these early cultures would grow and would overtake others in their environment. But as Ishmael correctly points out, the laws of nature would always bring back balance. But for me, and this is a difference for today, we know better. We are learning how devastating it is to grow without concern for other beings displaced. And for me, the difference is that in early cultures, they didn't have this knowledge. What makes Ishmael's message so compelling is that now we do know better, but we seem virtually unable to stop ourselves. Also, as Ishmael points out, the laws of nature will bring us back into balance, but it will be at a devastating cost if we do not change Mother Culture. As Unitarian Universalists, we are making great strides toward recognizing our responsibility to the nurturing of the earth on which we live. Each year at General Assembly, the continental meeting of 3,000 to 4,000 Unitarian Universalists, we take on life-transforming issues for our faith. In 2001, after 2 years of study, we passed the statement of conscience, "Responsible consumption is our moral imperative." Wow! And yet, I say this with some distress, the follow-through seems lacking. The phrase, "responsible consumption is our moral imperative," elegantly captures the sentiment of the urgent need for change, of the need to act responsibly as consumers, as life-giving and life-receiving participants in the interdependent web of existence. We must continue to ask the hard questions. How can we, as a denomination, as a congregation, and as individuals, take greater personal responsibility in our desire to change Mother Culture? Today, we are rightly concerned with politicians who do not take climate change seriously. On a scale unseen in human history, habitats are being disrupted and destroyed by short-term human desires and wants. In liberal religion, we are concerned with shaping the world to come, to make a world that is more just, a world that will survive and thrive another 1,000 years for all of nature's inhabitants. As Unitarian Universalists, we are called to do more than attend on Sunday mornings for a feel-good or feel-challenged message. We are called to act and to act boldly. At the beginning of his book, the beginning of the book, Ishmael, there is an idea put forth that I don't believe is fully developed. And it is this idea that I would like to end with. I will invite you to reflect on this idea silently, not once, but twice. In one of the first conversations with his student, Ishmael states that he teaches about captivity. This is more than physical captivity. My belief is that we are all captives of Mother Culture. We are all captives to a way of being that keeps us, for the most part, in lockstep with a culture of consumption, exploitation, and disregard for other sentient creatures. My invitation for reflection is in two parts. First, if Ishmael teaches about how we are captive to Mother Culture, my first question to you is this: how are you being held captive by Mother Culture? I invite you to reflect on this for 30 seconds. How are you being held captive by Mother Culture? My second question is this. If Ishmael teaches about captivity, what would freedom look like for you? I invite you to reflect on this question for 30 seconds. On this 48th anniversary of Earth Day, what significant changes would you make in your life to liberate yourself from the clutches of mother culture? I close by reading part of one verse of a hymn in our hymnal. The hymn is titled, I Wish I Knew How. It's one of my favorite hymns. I'm going to read this short part twice. I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all these chains holding me. I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all these chains holding me. May it be so.